pushing that activity. He also pushed the budget. It's true, as Garrett says, that his goal was to double the budget every year. The only other, I've forgotten completely my remark about the conjugate gradient system, method, so I won't say anything about that. The only other thing that I would like to mention, though, here, and this is in connection with Howard Aiken, is that I had the privilege of serving for at least a semester in 1953 as a visiting professor in the Division of Applied Mathematics, and I taught a course in Aiken's laboratory. The one thing I remember most keenly about that experience is a sign outside Aiken's laboratory: "Keep out."
Okay, we're on line. My name is Howlett. I was until recently the British Science Research Council's Atlas Computer Laboratory. I live in Oxford. This spring course, I knew this was going to be tremendously nostalgic. One of the things I'd like to say, one is there can't be very many people in the audience who actually worked with the original differential analyzer, which was built under sort of Hartree's inspiration as a Spidwell straight copy of the Bush machine. And I really had the gall to bring with me, from my own personal archives, a photograph of this machine, which I stuck on the board there, and I'm on it, and so is Hartree. So
is it true he made it from Meccano parts?
No, he made the original model from Meccano parts. Uh-huh. And that is in the Science Museum there, actually. Oh, yes, in fact, I worked with that for a bit. But I think what I want to say is this. It's really extremely interesting. During the war, I worked with Hartree on a number of classified things for the war effort. And at one stage, we were invited by Professor Piles, you know, could we provide a numerical solution for a certain nonlinear partial parabolic differential equation? He didn't say what it was all about, so we naturally tried to guess what it was, and Hartree got it right. It was, of course, the diffusion flux, you see. And it took us 1 year, those Hartree and four assistants, all for PhD types, you see, to get one numerical solution. You play around that off in about 5 minutes or less than that. But that was the only machine there was, you know, and curiously enough, it was we who were asked to do this. There were not the resources around anywhere else at the time. Well, things have changed. If I might, one or two other things. I was extremely interested to hear you saying about Southwell's opposition, for example, to what I might call the formalization. And I know very well, in fact, it was really very sad that Southwell, he held on to the sort of engineering analog so strongly and resisted all attempts. And if you want more information on that, I'm sure Jim Wilkinson knows, but certainly Leslie Fox, professor at Oxford, was one of Southwell's proteges. And Leslie, he really built up almost a lifelong enmity with Southwell in the end, because Fox insisted on looking into the mathematics. And of course, when you look into it, you find it's a much more powerful method. And I think the same thing's happened with finite element methods. The other thing is about these artificial intelligence things. I'm sure perhaps you know, but I'd like just to remind you, there was, I think it was 1952 in Paris, a meeting at the Institut Blaise Pascal, under the marvelous title, La grande machine à calculer et la pensée humaine. You know, that's terrific. And McCulloch was there, making absolutely categorical statements, you know, showing drawings of the interconnections between neurons, and it was all quite clear what it was going to be, you know. The other thing, of course, were the fancy grey Walter tortoise, as somebody may remember, crawling around the place and homing on. And just finally, just a word or two about von Neumann, whom I met only once, and it was a tremendous experience. But one of the things we got asked to do in this group with Hartree was to do a calculation on the spread of a spherical blast wave. And again, it was obvious what that was all about, you see. And we wanted to get a start. We never got anywhere, of course. It defeats. I mean, we have to differentialize other things. But we wanted to get an analytic start on the thing. And we got two papers, I think, were probably classified at the time, one by von Neumann and one by G.I. Taylor. And it's an interesting comparison between two exceedingly great men. Von Neumann tackled this with sheer mathematical power. You know, he took the equations and sort of, you know, shook them apart and forced his way through all sorts of difficulties, and it took it quite a long way. G.I., just by sheer knowledge of the physics, sort of produced the most elegant similarity solution. It was quite impossible how he got it, but just knowing what it was all going to be about, you see. Very, very interesting comparison indeed. Thank you.
If I may make a couple of further comments, which you have reminded me of, which I intended to include, the Wiener-McCulloch-Pitts, of course, relates to this large meeting. It was quite sad to me that there seemed to be fallings out between all these people. Pitts had a falling out finally with Wiener. What I remember was Pitts being interviewed for the Society of Fellows. And I was present at the interview, and I can't remember the name of the biologist who was there, who listened to Pitts, who was a quite self-confident young man at the time, describing the revolutionary discoveries that were going to be made by applying these switching circuit type ideas to the human brain. And after waiting a suitable length of time, he said, "Well, now, what organism are you going to make your biological experiments on?" And I forget now what the organism was that Pitts mentioned. It might have been the octopus. And he said, "Why did you pick this?" "Because it has the simplest brain." "No," said the biologist, "such and such has the simplest brain." And from then on, Pitts was absolutely out of consideration. He felt this was unprofessional. But it's rather sad to see those high hopes, coming really to very little. Hartree, of course, also visited Harvard two summers, I think in 48 and 49, possibly. And people like David Young had the advantage of frequent communication with him. One of his great precepts was that he never talked about making a computation without actually carrying it through. I audited one of his classes when I was at Cambridge in 1948, and I think if I've had any success with graduate students in this field, it's because I've always kept this maxim in mind, and everybody who got their degree in numerical analysis in the Harvard Math Department has done a lot of computing. Hartree was certainly one of the great leaders of that time.
Mockley. I have a story which may not match any of the wonderful ones you've just told, but it has one characteristic. It sort of combines Los Alamos and Harvard and the military even in this way. There came a time when UNIVAC people decided to give a UNIVAC 1, I believe, to Dr. Aiken's computation laboratory, presumably because Mr. Rand had some heart trouble or somebody, some medical reason behind it. That has nothing to do with the story. But what does have something to do with the story is that at the time of the presentation, a large delegation of Remington Rand, UNIVAC-type people, came up there to participate in the ceremony. And there was a lunch at a faculty club, I believe. And among the people who were to partake of this lunch was, of course, Dr. Aiken and President Pusey and a whole host of people who I regarded as salesmen and a man who perhaps some people will remember around here, General Groves, who was at that time the director of a peculiar kind of research for UNIVAC and Rem Rand. He was the director of advanced research. I had heard already from Metropolis and others evaluations of General Groves, but what I now have to tell you is simply this, that we didn't know what the seating arrangements would be, and I don't know who did, but we found General Groves sitting exactly opposite President Pusey and next to Dr. Aiken. Somehow, all of a sudden, somebody tugged on our arms and things, and General Groves was deposed to the way to the end of the table, which was a sort of a horseshoe-shaped table. And Eckert and I were ensconced with Pusey and Aiken. Well, we had some wonderful conversation, and that's the remainder of the story, which is very short, and that is President Pusey asked a very common question of, did anybody think or foresee at the time of these early calculators and so forth, that they would have any application, for instance, in business. And Eckert and I answered, "Oh, yes, yes, that's what we were looking forward to." And the point of this story to me was that Dr. Aiken, who, as somebody mentioned a little while ago, was going to be stuck with a white elephant after all the problems were solved, Dr. Aiken was extremely honest, and he didn't have to be. He told his boss, President Pusey, quite candidly, "No, I never saw anything like that." Thank you.
Randall, Newcastle upon Tyne. I have two questions, both to do with the pre-war period, Bush and Aiken, really rather related. One, can you tell us anything about the Rapid Arithmetical Machine project that Bush really started up, which indicates to me now that Bush had far more to do with digital work than most people realize. The second point is that it seems to me that both Bush and Aiken were two people, somewhat unusual people, in the extent to which they gave explicit credit to early work, early mechanical work, and particularly the work of Charles Babbage. I was wondering if you have any recollections of their discussions on those.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that both of your remarks are correct. Vannevar Bush was a very broad-gauged person, but I think it was really, frankly, MIT that put its eggs in the differential analyzer basket. I remember Norman Levinson telling me around 1945, I went over to look at the latest differential analyzer. It was about this wide, a great big machine, radiating heat in all directions. And Norman said to me, "You know, Harvard has stolen the march on MIT in this respect. You're way ahead of us in computing," which I found, you know, mildly gratifying. But Aiken certainly always felt that there was only the technology that was had advanced beyond Babbage. I think I will tell a pro-General Groves story, anti-MIT story, because General Groves is not beloved or was not beloved in the scientific community, and maybe you can see that even generals are human. At a dedication of a computer at John Hancock, I found myself chatting with General Groves, and he described how when he transferred from the University of Washington to MIT back in 1908 after a year's study, they told him he'd have to start all over again because obviously no other university, no other technological university was as progressive and as up-to-date and forward-looking. And he said, "Well, I had a calculus course last year," and he said, "Why should I take freshman calculus all over again?" They said, "Well, we're using a new book this year. It's going to be done on absolutely new principles." And he said, "What is the book?" And they told him, he said, "That's the book we used at the University of Washington last year." But nevertheless, he was made to take the course over again. So I think he was, I had up to that time sort of imagined him as a rather dubious character, but he was really quite a human guy.
Thank you, Garrett. Nick, are there any announcements? That the meeting is adjourned.